Major Rackham sat across from Peter Wigan in his office in Rotterdam.
"We are very concerned," said Rackham.
"So am I."
"What have you set in motion here, Peter?"
"Major," said Peter, "all I've done is keep pressing, using what small tools I have. They decide how to respond to that pressure. I was prepared for an invasion of Armenia or Nubia. I was prepared to take advantage of a mass expulsion of Muslims from some or all European nations."
"And war between India and China? Are you prepared for that?"
"These are your geniuses, Maser, yours and Graf's. You trained them. You explained to me why Alai and Verlomi are doing something so stupid and suicidal as to throw badly armed Indian troops against Hansu's battle-hardened, fully equipped, revenge-hungry army."
"So that's not something you did."
"I'm not like you and Graf. I don't think I'm some master puppeteer. I've got this amount of power and influence in the world, and it doesn't amount to much. I have a billion or so citizens who have not yet become a genuine nation, so I have to keep dancing just to keep the FPE viable. I have a military force which is well-trained and well-equipped, has excellent morale, and is so small it wouldn't even be noticed on a battlefield in China or India. I have my personal reputation as Locke, and my not-so-empty-anymore office as hegemon. And I have been, both his actual abilities and his extravagant reputation. That's my arsenal. Do you see anything in that list that would allow me to even think of starting a war between two major world powers over whom I have no influence?"
"It just played into your hands so nicely. We couldn't help but think you had something to do with it."
"No, you did. You made these kids crazy in battle school. Now they're all mad kings using the lives of their subjects as playing pieces in a tawdry game of one-upsmanship."
Rackham sat back, looking a little sick. "We didn't want this either. And I don't think they're crazy. Somebody must see some advantage in starting this war, and yet I can't think who. You're the only one who stands to gain, so we thought."
"Believe it or not, I would not start a war like this, even if I thought I could profit from picking up the pieces. The only people who start wars that are bound to depend on human waves getting cut down by machine guns are fanatics or idiots. I think we can safely rule out idiocy, so that leaves Verlomi."
"That's what we're afraid of, that she actually comes to believe her image. God-blessed and irresistible." Rackham raised an eyebrow. "But you knew that. You met with her."
"She proposed marriage to me. I turned her down."
"Before she went to Alai?"
"I have a feeling that she married Alai on the rebound."
"She offered you India."
"She offered me an entanglement. I turned it into an opportunity."
"You knew when you turned her down that she'd be angry and do something stupid?"
Peter shrugged. "I knew she'd do something spiteful, something to show her power. I had no idea she'd try a lie, and I certainly had no idea he'd actually fall for it. Didn't he know she was crazy? I mean, not clinically, but drunk on power."
"You tell me why he did it."
"He was one of Ender's geesh. You and Graf must have so much paper on a lie that you know when he scratches his butt."
Rackham only waited.
"Look, I don't know why he did it, except maybe he thought he could control her. When he came home from Eros, he was a naive and righteous Muslim boy who's been sheltered ever since. Maybe he just wasn't ready to deal with a real live woman. The question now is, how will this play out?"
"How do you think it will play out?"
"Why should I tell you what I think? What possible advantage will I get from you and Graf knowing what I'm expecting and what I'm preparing to do about it?"
"How will it hurt?"
It'll hurt because if you decide your goals are different from mine, you'll meddle. Some of your meddling I've appreciated, but right now I don't want either the IF or Coleman doing one damn thing. I'm juggling too many balls to want some volunteer juggler to come in and try to help.
Peter, Graf was so right about you.
What?
When he rejected you for battle school.
Because I was too aggressive. And look what he actually accepted.
Peter, think about what you just said.
Peter thought about it. You mean about juggling?
I mean about why you were rejected for battle school.
Peter immediately felt stupid. His parents had been told that he was rejected because he was too aggressive, dangerously so. And he had wormed that information out of him at a very young age. Ever since then, it had been a burden he carried around inside. The judgment that he was dangerous. Sometimes it had made him bold. More often, it had made him not trust his own judgment, his own moral framework. Am I doing this because it's right? Am I doing this because it will really be to my benefit? Or only because I'm aggressive and can't stand to sit back and wait? He had forced himself to be more patient, more subtle than his first impulse. Time after time, he had held back. It was because of this that he had used Valentine and now Petra to write the more dangerous demagogic essays. He didn't want any kind of textual analysis to point to him as the author. It was why he had held back from any kind of serious arm-twisting with nations that kept playing with him about joining the FPE. He couldn't afford to have anyone perceive him as coercive. And all this time, that assessment of him was a lie. I'm not too aggressive.
It's impossible to be too aggressive for battle school. Reckless, now that would be dangerous. But nobody has ever called you reckless, have they? And your parents would have known that was a lie, because they could have seen what a calculating little bastard you were, even at the age of 7.
Why, thanks.
No, Graf looked at your tests and watched what the monitor showed us, and then he talked to me and showed me, and we realized you weren't what we wanted as commander of the army because people don't love you. Sorry, but it's true. You're not warm. You don't inspire devotion. You would have been a good commander under someone like Ender. But you could never have held the whole thing together the way he did.
I'm doing fine now. Thanks.
You're not commanding soldiers. Peter, do Bean or Suri love you? Would they die for you? Or do they serve you because they believe in your cause?
They think the world united under me as hegemon would be better than the world united under anyone else, or not united at all.
A simple calculation.
A calculation based on trust that I've damn well earned.
But not personal devotion. Even Valentine, she was never devoted to you, and she knew you better than anyone.
She pretty much hated me.
Too strong, Peter. Too strong a word. She didn't trust you. She feared you. She saw your mind like clockwork, very smart. She always figured you were 6 steps ahead of her.
Peter shrugged.
But you weren't, were you?
Ruling the world isn't a chess game. Or if it is, it's a game with 1,000 powerful pieces and 8 billion pawns. And the pieces keep changing their capabilities and the game board never stays the same. So just how far ahead can you possibly see? All I could do was put myself into a position with the most possible influence, and then exploit whatever opportunities came.
Rackham nodded. But one thing was certain. Your off-the-charts aggressiveness, your passion to control events, we knew that you would place yourself in the center of everything.
It was Peter's turn to laugh. So you left me home from battle school so I would be what I am now.
As I said, you weren't suited for military life. You don't take orders very well. People aren't devoted to you, and you aren't devoted to anyone else.
I might be, if I found somebody I respected enough.
The only person you ever respected that much is on a colony ship right now, and you'll never see him again.
I could never have followed Ender.
No, you never could. But he's the only person you respected enough. The trouble was, he was your younger brother. You couldn't have lived with the shame.
Well, all this analysis is nice, but how does it help us now?
We don't have a plan either, Peter. We're also just moving useful pieces into place, taking others out of play. We have some assets, just as you do. We have our arsenal.
You have the whole IF. You could put a stop to all of this.
No. Polemarch Shamrajnagar is adamant about it, and he's right. We could force the world's armies to come to a halt. They would all obey us or pay a terrible price. But who would be ruling the world, then?
The fleet.
And who is the fleet? It's volunteers from Earth. And from that moment on, who would be our volunteers? People who love the idea of going out into space? Or people who want to control the government of Earth? It would turn us into an Earth-centered institution. It would destroy the colonization project. And the fleet would be hated, because it would soon be dominated by people who loved power.
Makes you sound like a bunch of nervous virgins.
We are. And that's a strange line coming from a nervous virgin like you.
Peter didn't bother responding to that. So, you and Graf won't do anything that would compromise the purity of the IF?
Unless somebody brings out the nukes again. We won't let that happen. Two nuclear wars were enough.
We never had a nuclear war.
World War II was a nuclear war, even if only two bombs were dropped, and the bomb that destroyed Mecca was the end of a civil war within Islam being fought out through surrogates and terrorism. Ever since then, nobody has even considered using nukes. But wars that are ended by nukes are nuclear wars.
Fine. Definitions.
Hiram and I are doing everything we can. So is the Polemarch. And believe it or not, we're trying to help you. We want you to succeed.
And now you're pretending that you've been rooting for me all along?
Not at all. We had no idea whether you'd be a tyrant or a wise ruler. No idea of what method you'd use or what your world government would be like. We knew you couldn't do it by charisma because you don't have much. And I'll admit, you emerged with greater clarity after we got a good look at Ashiel.
So, you didn't really get behind me until you realized I was better than Ashiel.
Your achievements were so extraordinary that we were still wary of you. Then Ashiel showed us that you were actually cautious and self-restrained compared to what could have been done by somebody who was truly ruthless. We saw a tyrant on the make, and we realized you weren't one.
Depending on how you define tyrant.
Peter, we're trying to help you. We want you to unite the world under civilian government. Without any advice from us, you've determined to do it by persuasion and plebiscite instead of using armies and terror.
I use armies.
You know what I mean.
I just didn't want you to have any illusions.
So tell me what you're thinking, what you're planning, so we won't interfere with our meddling.
Because you're on my side? Peter said scornfully.
No, we're not on your side. We're not really in this game, except insofar as it affects us. We're in the business of dispersing the human race to as many worlds as possible. But so far, only 2 colony ships have taken off, and it will be another generation before any of them lands. Far longer before we know whether the colonies will take hold and succeed. Even longer than that before we know if they'll become isolated worlds, or trade will be profitable enough to make interstellar travel economically feasible. That's all we care about. But to accomplish it, we have to get recruits from Earth, and we have to pay for the ships, again, from Earth. And we have to do it without any hope of financial return for 100 years at the best. Capitalism is not good at thinking 100 years ahead. So we need government funding.
Which you've managed to get, even when I couldn't raise a dime.
No, Peter. Don't you understand? Everybody except the United States and Britain and a handful of smaller countries has stopped paying their assessments. We're living off our huge cash reserves. It's been enough to outfit 2 ships, to build a new class of gravity-controlled messenger ships, a few projects like that. But we're running out of money. We have no way to finance even the ships we already have under construction.
You want me to win, so I'll pay for your fleet.
We want you to win so that the human race can stop spending its vast surpluses on ways to kill each other, and can instead send all the people that would have been killed in war out into space. And all the money that would have been spent on weapons can be spent on colony ships and on trading ships eventually. The human race has always produced a vast surplus of human beings and of wealth, and it has used up almost all of it, either on stupid monuments like the pyramids or on brutal, bloody, pointless wars. We want you to unite the world so that this waste can finally stop.
You are such dreamers, such idealists.
We were warriors. And we studied our enemy, the Hive Queens. They failed because they were too unified. Human beings are a better design for a sentient species, once we get over this war thing. What the Hive Queens tried, we can do. Spread out the species so it can develop truly new cultures.
New cultures? When you insist that each colony be made up entirely of people from one nation, one language group?
We're not absolutely rigid on that, but yes. There are 2 ways of looking at species diversity. One is that every colony should contain a complete copy of the whole human race, every culture, every language, every race. But what's the point of that? Earth already has that. And look how well it's worked. No. The great colonies of the past have succeeded precisely because they were internally unified. People who knew each other, trusted each other, shared the same purposes, embraced the same laws. Each one monochromatic to begin with. But when we send out 50 monochromatic colony ships, but all different colors, so to speak, 50 different colonies, each with a separate cultural and linguistic root, then the human race can perform 50 different experiments. Real species diversity.
I don't care what you say. I'm not going.
Rackham smiled. We don't want you to.
The 2 colony ships you've launched, one of them was Ender's.
That's right.
Who's the commander of the 2nd ship?
Well, the ship is commanded by...
Who's going to rule the colony?
Dink Meeker.
So that was the plan. They meant to take Anders Jeesh and anybody else who was dangerously talented in a military way and send them off into space. So to you, this war between Hansu and Alai is your worst nightmare.
Rackham nodded.
Don't worry.
Don't worry.
All right. Worry if you want. But your offer to Ender's Jeesh to take them all off-planet to give them colonies. Now I understand what it's about. You care about these kids whose lives you co-opted. You want to get them off into worlds where there's no rival. They can use their talents to help a community triumph over a new world.
Yes.
But the most important thing is, they won't be on Earth.
Rackham shrugged.
You knew that nobody could ever unite the world as you need it to be united while these highly trained, highly aggressive, public certified geniuses are still in it.
We didn't see a way it could happen.
Well, that's a lie. You saw the way it would happen because it's obvious. One of them would be ruler of Earth because all the others would be dead.
Yes, we saw that, but it wasn't an option.
Why not? It's the human way of settling things.
We love these kids, Peter.
But love them or not, they'll all die eventually. No, I think you would have been content to let them work it out if you thought it would work. If you thought one of them would emerge triumphant. What you couldn't stand was the knowledge that they were so evenly matched that none of them would win. They'd use up the resources of Earth, all that surplus population, and still there'd be no clear winner.
That wouldn't help anything.
So if you could have found a cure for Bean's condition, you wouldn't need me, because Bean could do it. He could defeat the others. He could unite the world, because he's so much better than they are.
But he's going to die.
And you love him, and you're going to try to save his life.
We want him to help you win first.
That's not possible. Not in the time he has left.
By win, I mean we want him to help you get into a position where your victory is inevitable, given your abilities. Right now, you could be stopped by all kinds of chance events. Having Bean increases your power and influence. Another thing that would help is if we could get the rest of the Geesh off this planet. If we've removed from the board all the pieces that could challenge you, if, in effect, you're the queen in a game of knights and bishops, then you won't need Bean anymore.
I'll need somebody. I'm not trained for war the way these battle school kids were. And, as you said, I'm not the kind of guy that soldiers want to die for.
Rackham leaned forward. Peter, tell us what you're planning.
I'm not planning anything. I'm simply waiting. When I met Philomi, I realized that she was the key to everything. She's volatile, she's powerful, and she's drunk. I knew that she'd do something destabilizing, something that would break things apart.
So you think the war between India and China will happen, and that Allies Muslim League will be drawn into it?
That's possible. I hope it won't happen.
But if it does, you'll be poised to attack Ali when his forces are tied up fighting China.
No.
No?
We're not going to attack anybody.
Then what? Whoever emerges from that war...
I don't think that war is going to amount to much, if it happens at all. But if it does happen, then both sides will be weakened by it. There's no shortage of ambitious nations ready to step in and pick up the pieces.
So what do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. I wish you'd believe me. There is only one thing I'm sure of. Allies and Velomi's marriage is doomed. And if you want either or both of them to command any of your precious colonies, you'd better make sure you're ready to get them off planet fast.
Are you planning something?
No. Are you listening? I'm watching the whole damn thing just like you are. I've already played my cards, making the Muslim leadership suspicious of my intentions, provoking them, plus a little quiet diplomacy.
With whom?
With Russia.
You're trying to get them to join with you in attacking Ali? Or China?
No, no, no. If I tried anything like that, word would get out, and then what Muslim nation would ever, ever join the FPE?
So what are you doing with your diplomacy?
Begging the Russians to stay out of it.
In other words, pointing out the opportunity and telling them that you're not going to interfere in any way.
Yes.
politics is so indirect.
That's why conquerors rarely make great rulers.
And great rulers are rarely conquerors.
You close the door on my becoming a conqueror. So, if I'm to be the ruler of the world, a good one, then I have to win that position in such a way as not to have to keep killing people in order to stay in power. It does the world no good if everything depends on me, if it all collapses when I die. I need to build this thing piece by piece, bit by bit, with powerful institutions that have their own momentum, so that it will make very little difference who's at the head. It's what I learned from growing up in America. It was a nation created out of nothing. Nothing but a set of ideals that they never measured up to. Now and then they had great leaders, but usually nothing but political hacks, and I mean right from the start. Washington was great, but Adams was paranoid and lazy, and Jefferson was as vile a scheming politician as a nation has ever been cursed with. I learned a lot from him about destroying your enemies with demagoguery conducted under pseudonyms.
So you were praising him?
I'm saying that America shaped itself with institutions so strong that it could survive corruption, stupidity, vanity, ambition, recklessness, and even insanity in its chief executive. I'm trying to do the same thing with the free people of Earth. Base it on some simple but workable ideals. Bring nations into it because they freely choose to join. Unite them with a language and a system of laws, and give them a stake in institutions that take on a life of their own. And I can't do any of that if I conquer a single country and force it to join. That's a rule I can never violate. My forces will defeat enemies who attack the FPE and will carry war into their territory to do it. But when it comes to joining the FPE, they can only do it if a majority of the people want to, if they choose to be subject to our laws and take part in our institutions.
But you're not above getting other nations to do your conquering for you.
Islam has never learned how to be a religion. It's a tyranny by its very nature. Until it learns to let the door swing both ways and permit Muslims to decide not to be Muslim without penalty, then the world has no choice but to fight against it in order to remain free. As long as Muslim nations remained divided, working against each other, they weren't going to be a problem for me because I could pick them up one by one, especially after the FPE becomes large enough for them to see how the people within my borders prosper.
But united under a lie.
A lie is a decent guy. I think he has some idea of liberalizing Islam from the top. But it can't be done. He's simply wrong. He's a general, not a politician. As long as ordinary Muslims believe it is their duty to kill any Muslim who tries to quit being a Muslim, as long as they think they have a holy duty to resort to arms to compel unbelievers to obey Islamic law, you can't liberalize that. You can't make it a decent system for anybody, not even for Muslims. Because the cruelest, narrowest, most evil people will always rise to power, because they'll always be the ones most willing to wrap themselves in the crescent flag and murder people in God's name.
So a lie is doomed to fail.
A lie is doomed to die. The moment the fanatics realize that he's not as fanatically pure a Muslim as they are, they'll kill him.
And install a new caliph?
They can install whoever they want. It won't matter to me. Without a lie, there's no Islamic unity, because only a lie can lead them to victory. And in defeat, Muslims don't stay united. They move like a great wave until they meet a wall of rock that doesn't move. Then they crash and recede.
As they did after Charles Martel defeated them.
It's a lie who made them powerful. The only trouble is, Ally doesn't like the things he has to do in order to rule a totalitarian system like Islam. He's already killed a lot more people than he wanted to. Ally's not a killer, but he's become one. And he likes it less and less.
You think he's not going to follow Virlomi into war?
It's a race between followers of Ally who plan to kill Virlomi in order to free Ally from her influence, and fanatical Muslims who plan to kill Ally because he betrayed Islam by marrying Virlomi in the first place.
Do you know who the conspirators are?
I don't have to. If there weren't any conspirators planning murder, it wouldn't be a Muslim empire. And there's another race. Can they kill Ally or Virlomi before China or Russia attacks? And even if they do kill one or both of them, will that stop China or Russia from attacking? Or simply encourage them to think that victory will be more likely?
And is there any scenario where you'll go to war?
Yes. If they get rid of Virlomi and Russia and China don't attack, then Ally, or his successor, if they kill him too, will be pushed into attacking Armenia and Nubia. And that's a war I'm ready to fight. We'll destroy them. We'll be the rock against which Islam crashes and breaks into pieces.
And if Russia or China does attack them before they can turn to you, then you still profit from the war as frightened nations unite with you against either Russia or China, whichever country is seen as the aggressive, dangerous one.
It's like I said. I have no idea how things will turn out. I just know that I am ready to take advantage of every situation I can think of. And I'm watching very closely, so that if something happens that I haven't foreseen, I can take advantage of it.
So here's the key question. It's the information I came here to get.
I'm dying to hear.
How long are you going to need Bean?
Peter thought about that one for a while. I've had to make my plans knowing that he was going to die, or once you made him your offer, leave. So the answer is, as long as I have him, of course I'll use him, either to intimidate would-be enemies or to command my forces when we go to war. But if he dies or leaves, I can make do. My plans don't depend on having Bean.
So if he left in 3 months?
Rackham, have you already found his other children? Is that what you're saying? Have you found them and you aren't telling him and Petra because you think I need Bean?
Not all of them.
You're cold. You're such bastards. You're still using children as your tools.
Yes, said Rackham, we're bastards. But we mean well. Just like you.
Give Bean and Petra their babies, and save his life if you can. He's a good man, who deserves better than to have you toy with him any longer.
Chapter 21 Papers From The Impaled One to Honest Abe, Lincoln at railsplitter.org/write-to-the-author Ray God help me. Sometimes you give advice assuming that no one will take it. I just hope the man upstairs will forgive me and still find a place for me. Meanwhile, tell the big guy he's got to do something about the cup I broke. From Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov to Graf, pilgrimage at coleman.gov Forward Ray, God help me. Dear Hiram, as you will see from below, our Slavic friend has apparently offered suggestions to his government that they actually took, and he regrets it. Assuming that you're the guy upstairs, I would guess this open encryption suggests he wants out. My sources last put him in Florida, but if they're watching him closely, they would have moved him to Idaho. As for the cup he broke, I think he means that instead of Russia looking for a chance to attack Ally, they've made a deal with the Muslim League, and while China looks south to fight India, Russia is going to move on Hanzhou from the north, while the Turks move from the west, the Indonesians from Taiwan, and Verlomi's insane invasion will go on over the mountains. Not so insane now. However, on the chance that by the big guy, Russian boy meant somebody other than the man upstairs, he could only mean a certain giant we both know. I'll confer with him and Mrs. Giant about what, if anything, we can do to deal with the situation. Peter.
Ali had given his orders, and now he was going to make sure he was out of Hyderabad when they were carried out. The Caliph could not be tainted with the arrest of his own wife. But the Caliph could not be ruled by her either. Ali knew that the wazirs of his council hated her. If he did not have her arrested by men loyal to him, then she would certainly be killed. Later, after things had settled down, after she had regained her senses and stopped thinking she was unstoppable, he would take her out of prison. He could not release her in India, that was out of the question. Maybe Graf would take her. She wasn't one of Ender's Jeesh, but by the same reasoning Graf had used in his invitation, the world would certainly be a safer place with her gone from it, while a colony might be lucky to have someone of such ability and ambition at its head. Meanwhile, without Virlomi, there was no reason for him to govern from Hyderabad. He would continue to respect his treaty with India and withdraw his forces. Let them try to rebuild, without Virlomi's madness trying to throw them prematurely into war. India would not be in shape to mount a meaningful military campaign against anything more substantial than a flock of starlings for many years to come. Ali would spend the next few years putting Islam's house in order and trying to forge a real nation out of this mishmash that history had left for him to deal with. If Syrians and Iraqis and Egyptians couldn't get along with each other and despised each other the moment they heard the other's accent, how could anyone expect Moroccans and Persians and Uzbeks and Malays to see the world in the same way just because a muezzin called them to prayer? Besides, he had to deal with the stateless peoples, the Kurds, the Berbers, half the nomad tribes of ancient Bactria. Ali knew perfectly well that these Muslims would not follow a caliph who kept the status quo. Not when Peter Wiggin was tempting revolutionaries everywhere with his promise of statehood and the examples of Runa and Nubia. We brought Nubia on ourselves, thought Ali. The ancient Muslim contempt for blackest Africa still seethed under the surface. If Ali had not been a member of Ender's Jeesh, it would have been inconceivable for him, as a black African, to be named caliph. It was in Sudan, where the races met face to face, that the ugliness had emerged with so much virulence. The rest of Islam should have disciplined Sudan long ago, and now they all paid the price, with the humiliation of Sudan at the hands of the FPE. So we have to give the Kurds and Berbers their own governments. Real ones, not sham, autonomous regions. That would not be popular in Morocco and Iraq and Turkey, Ali knew. That's why it was stupid in the extreme to imagine embarking on wars of conquest when there was no peace or unity inside the world of Islam. Ali would govern from Damascus. It was far more central. He would be surrounded by Muslim culture instead of Hindu. It would be a civilian-centered government, not an obvious military dictatorship, and the world would see that Islam was not interested in conquering the world, that Caliph Ali had already liberated more people from oppressive conquerors than Peter Wiggin ever could. As Ali left his office, two of the guards fell in step beside him. Ever since Virlomi simply walked into his office the day they got married, Alamandar had insisted that it not be so easy to walk into highly sensitive areas of the compound. "We are in occupied enemy country, my caliph," he had said, and he was right. Still, there was something that made Ali uneasy about having to be accompanied by guards as he moved about the compound. It felt wrong. The caliph should be able to move among his own people with perfect trust and openness. As Ali stepped through the door into the parking garage, two more guards joined the two who had walked with him from upstairs. His limousine sat idling at the curb. The back door opened. He saw someone jogging toward him from among the parked cars. It was Ivan Lankovsky. Ali had rewarded him for his loyal service by putting him in charge of the administration of the Turkish nations of Central Asia. What was he doing here? Ali had not called him back from service, and Ivan had not written or called about coming. Ivan reached into his jacket, where a gun would be if he was armed with a shoulder holster. And he would be armed. He had carried a gun for too many years to be comfortable without one now. Alamander got out of the open back door of the limo. As he rose to his feet, he shouted at the guards, "Shoot him, you fools! He's going to kill the caliph!" Ivan's gun was out. He fired, and the guard to Ali's left dropped like a rock. The sound was strange. The barrel had a silencer, but Ali was close to being directly in front of it, so it wasn't so much silenced as shaped. "I should drop to the ground," thought Ali. "To save my life, I should get out of the line of fire." But he couldn't take the danger seriously. He didn't feel as though he were in danger at all. The other guards had their guns out now. Ivan shot another one. But then the bullets, not silenced, flew in the other direction, and Ivan fell to the ground. His gun did not slip from his hand. He maintained his grip on it to the end of his life. Or maybe he wasn't dead. Maybe he could spend his last moments explaining to Ali how he could betray him like this. Ali walked to Ivan's body and felt for a pulse. Ivan's eyes were open. He was already dead. "Come away, my caliph!" shouted Alamandar. "There may be other conspirators." Conspirators? There was no possibility of other conspirators. Ivan didn't trust anybody enough to conspire with them. The only person Ivan absolutely trusted was me. Ivan was a perfect shot. Even at a run, he could not have aimed at me and then clumsily hit two guards. "My guards," said Ali, looking up at Alamandar, "the ones he shot, will they be all right?" One of the other guards jogged back to look. "Both dead," he said. But Ali already knew that. Ivan had not been aiming at Ali. He had come here with one purpose in mind, the purpose that had guided him for years. Ivan was here to protect his caliph. It flashed into Ali's mind with immediate clarity. Ivan had learned of a conspiracy against the caliph, and it involved people so close to Ali that there was no way for Ivan to warn him from a distance without running the risk of alerting one of the conspirators. Ali reached with one hand to close Ivan's eyes, while with the other he pulled Ivan's pistol from his slackened fingers. Still not taking his eyes off Ivan's face, Ali fired the pistol upward into the guard who was standing over him. Then he calmly aimed at the guard who had gone back to the bodies and fired. Ali had never been as good a shot as Ivan. He could not have done this while running. But kneeling, he was all right. The guard he had shot without looking was lying on the pavement, twitching. Ali shot him again, then turned to Alamandar, who was getting back into the limo. Ali shot him. He fell into the car, and it screeched away from the curb. But the door was not closed yet, and Alamandar was in no shape to close it. So, as it passed Ali, there would be a brief moment when the driver would be unprotected by the heavy armoring and bulletproof glass. Ali laid down three quick shots in order to have a better chance of catching that moment. It worked. The car did not turn. It ran into a wall. Ali jogged over to the still-open back door of the car, where Alamandar was panting and holding his chest. His eyes were on fire with rage and fear as Ali leveled Ivan's pistol to fire. "You are no caliph," gasped Alamandar. "The Hindu woman is more of a caliph than you are, you black dog." Ali shot him in the head, and he fell silent. The driver was unconscious, but Eli shot him too. Then he went back to the bodies of the guards who were dressed in Western business suits. Ivan had shot one of them in the head. He was larger than Eli, but his clothing would do. Eli had his white robe off in a moment. Underneath, he wore jeans, as he always did. After wrestling with the corpse for a few moments, he got the shirt and jacket off the man, and without popping any of the buttons off. Eli took the pistols from the two guards who had never gotten off a shot and dropped them into the pockets of the jacket he now wore. Ivan's silenced pistol had to be nearly out of bullets, so Eli slid it across the pavement back toward Ivan's body. Where do I imagine an African man can hide in Hyderabad? No one's face was more recognizable than the Caliph's, and those who didn't know his face knew his race. They would also know that he spoke no Hindi. He would not make it 100 meters outside in Hyderabad. Then again, there was no chance he could get out of the compound alive. Wait. Think. Don't wait. Get away from this murder scene. Eli jogged through the parked cars. The garage would have been cleared of any observers by Alamandar's men. That meant Ivan must have been hidden inside a car. Where was that car? Keys in the ignition. Thank you, Ivan. You planned for everything. No time would be wasted fumbling with keys as you dragged me to your car to get me out of here. Where were you going to take me, Ivan? Whom do you trust? Alamandar's last words rang in his ears. The Hindu woman is more of a caliph than you are. He thought they all hated her, but now he realized that she was the one advocating war, expansion, the restoration of a great empire. That's what they wanted. And all his talk of peace, of consolidation, of reforming Islam from the inside before reaching out to the rest of the world, of competing with Peter Wiggin using the same methods, inviting other nations to join the caliphate without requiring them to become Muslim or live under Sharia. They had listened, they had agreed, but they hated it. They hated him. So when they saw the break between him and Virlomi, they exploited it. Or was Virlomi behind this? Was Virlomi pregnant with his child? The caliph is dead, but here is his baby, born after he died, but infused with the gifts of God from his birth. In the name of the baby caliph, the council of wazirs will rule. And since the mother of the new caliph is ruler of India, he will join the two great nations in one. With Virlomi as regent, of course. No, Virlomi could not have wanted him murdered. Ivan would have an airplane waiting. The airplane that brought him, with his own trusted crew. Eli drove at a normal pace. But he did not drive to the checkpoint where he normally entered the airport grounds. In all likelihood, that place would be manned by the conspirators. Instead, he went to a service gate. The guard sauntered over and started to tell him only authorized service vehicles could use this gate. I'm the caliph, and I want to go through this gate. Oh, said the guard, looking confused. I see, He pulled out a cell phone and started to punch at it. Eli didn't want to kill this man. He was an idiot, not a conspirator. So he swung the door open, bumping into the man. Not hard, just enough to get his attention. Then he closed the door and reached through the window. Give me that cell phone. The soldier gave it to him. Eli switched it off. I'm the caliph. When I say to let me through, you don't have to ask anyone else's permission. The soldier nodded and ran to the controls, and the gate slid open. As soon as Eli was through the gate, he saw a small corporate jet with Cyrillic lettering under the common letters naming the corporation, the kind of plane Ivan would have used. The engines started up as Eli approached. No, as Ivan's car approached. Eli stopped the car and got out. The door of the jet was open, forming steps to the ground. Holding one hand on the pistol in his pocket, for he was taking this plane whether it was Ivan's or not, Eli walked up the steps. A businessman, or so he seemed, waited for him inside. Where is Ivan? He asked. We're not waiting for him, said Alai. He died saving me. The man nodded once, then went to the door and pushed the button to raise it. Meanwhile, he shouted, Let's go! And then said to Alai, Please sit down and fasten your seatbelt, my caliph. The plane began taxiing before the door was closed. Do nothing out of the ordinary, said Alai. Nothing to alert them. There are weapons here that could easily shoot down this plane. Our plan exactly, sir, said the man. What would the conspirators do when they found out that Alai had escaped? They would do nothing. They would say nothing. As long as Alai might turn up alive somewhere, they dared not be on record as saying anything. In fact, they would continue to act in his name. If they followed Virlomi's plans, if her insane invasion went forward, then Alai would know they were with her. When they were in the air, having waited for ordinary permission from the controllers, Ivan's man came back and stood diffidently 2 meters away. My caliph, if I may ask. Alai nodded. How did he die? He was busy shooting the guards surrounding me. He got 2 of them before they cut him down. I used his weapon to kill the others, including Alamandar. Do you know how far the conspiracy went? No, sir, said the man. We only knew that you would be killed on the airplane to Damascus. And this airplane, where is it taking me? It has a very long range, sir, said the man. Where will you feel safe?
Petra's mother was tending the babies, while Petra and Bean oversaw the last preparations for the opening of hostilities. Peter's message had been terse. How busy can you keep the Turks while watching out for Russians in the rear? Turks and Russians allies, or potentially so. What game was Alai playing? Was Vlad in it? Trust Peter not to share any more information than he thought he had to, which was invariably less than other people actually needed. Still, she and Bean had been spending every spare moment working out ways, using limited, under-trained, and under-equipped Armenian forces to cause maximum disruption. A raid on the most highly visible Turkish target, Istanbul, would enrage them without accomplishing anything. Blocking the Dardanelles would be a harsh blow against all the Turks, but there was no way to project that much force from Armenia to the western shore of the Black Sea and maintain it. Oh, for the days when oil was strategically important. Back then, the Russian, Azerbaijani, and Persian wells in the Caspian would have been a prime target for disruption. But now the wells had all been dismantled, and the Caspian was mostly used as a source of water, which was desalinated and pumped over to irrigate fields around the Aral Sea, with the runoff being used to replenish that once dying lake. And to strike at the water pipeline would impoverish poor farmers without affecting the enemy's ability to wage war. The plan they finally came up with was simple enough, once you bought the concept. There's no way to strike the Turks directly, said Bean. Nothing is centralized. So we'll strike Iran. It's highly urbanized, the big cities are all in the northwest, and there'll be an immediate demand for Iranian troops to come home from India to fight us. The Turks will be under pressure to help, and when they launch a very badly planned attack against Armenia, we'll be waiting. What makes you think it will be badly planned? Petra asked. Because Alai isn't running the show on the Muslim side. When did this happen? If Alai were in control, said Bean, he wouldn't let Virlomi do what she's doing in India. It's too stupid and it will kill too many men. So, somehow he's lost control. And if that's the case, the Muslim enemy we're facing is incompetent and fanatic. They're acting out of anger and panic, with poor planning. What if this is Alai's doing? And you don't know him as well as you think. Petra, said Bean, we know Alai. Yes, and he knows us. Alai is a builder, like Ender. He always has been. An empire won through audacious and bloody conquest isn't worth having. He wants to build his Muslim empire the way Peter is building the FPE, by transforming Islam into a system that other nations will want voluntarily to join. Only somebody's decided not to follow his path. Either Verlomi or the hotheads within his own government. Or both? Asked Petra. Anything's possible. Except a lie controlling the Muslim armies. Well, it's simple enough, said Bean. If we're wrong, and the Turkish counterattack is brilliantly planned, then we'll lose. As slowly as possible. And hope Peter has something else up his sleeve. But our assignment is to draw Turkish forces and attention away from China. And meanwhile, we'll be putting pressure on the Muslim alliance, said Petra. No matter what the Turks do, the Persians won't believe they're doing enough. Sunni against Shiite, said Bean. It's the best I could think up. So for the past 2 days, they had been drawing up plans for the quick, audacious airborne attack on Tabriz. And then, when the Iranians started to react to that, an immediate evacuation and airborne attack on Tehran. Meanwhile, Petra, in command of the defense of Armenia, would be prepared to make the Turkish counterattack pay for every meter of progress through the mountains. Now everything was ready, awaiting only the word from Peter. Petra and Bean weren't really necessary while the troops began their deployment, and supplies were moved to depots in the areas where they'd be needed. Everything was in the hands of the Armenian military. What scares me, Petra told Bean, is how they have absolute confidence that we know what we're doing. Why does that scare you? Doesn't it scare you? Petra, we do know what we're doing. We just don't know why. It was in that lull, between planning and getting the order to go ahead, that Petra got a call on her cell phone from her mother. Petra, they say they're friends of yours, but they're taking the babies. Panic stabbed through her. Who's with them? Put the one in charge on the phone. He won't. He just says, the teacher says to meet them at the airport. Who's the teacher? Oh, God help us, Petra. This is like the time they kidnapped you. Tell them we'll be at the airport, and if they've hurt the babies, I'll kill them. But no, Mother, it's not the same thing at all. Unless it was. She told Bean what was happening, and they calmly made their way to the airport. They saw Rackham waiting at the curb, and made the driver let them off there. I'm sorry to frighten you, said Rackham, but we don't have time for arguments until we get on the plane. Then you can scream at me all you like. Nothing is so urgent you have to steal our babies, said Petra, putting as much venom into her voice as she could. See, said Rackham, arguing instead of coming with me. They followed him then, through back passages and out to a private jet. Petra protested as they went. Nobody knows where we are. They'll think we ran out on them. They'll think we were kidnapped. Rackham just ignored her. He moved very quickly for a man so old. The babies were on the plane, each one being cared for by a separate nurse. They were fine. Only Ramon was still nursing, because the two with Bean syndrome were eating more or less solid food now. So Petra sat down and fed him, while Rackham sat down opposite them in the luxury jet and, as the plane took off, began his explanation. We had to get you out of there now, he said. Because the airport at Yerevan is going to be blown to bits in an hour or two, and we need to be out over the Black Sea before it happens.
How do you know? Demanded Petra.
We have it from the man who planned the attack.
A lie?
It's a Russian attack, said Rackham. Bean blew up.
Then what was all that kuzo about distracting the Turks?
It all still applies. As soon as we see the attack planes take off from southern Russia, I'll let you know, and you can give the word to launch your attack on Iran.
This is Vlad's plan, said Petra. A sudden preemptive strike to keep the FPE from doing anything, to neutralize me and Bean.
Vlad wants you to know he's very sorry. He's used to none of his plans actually being used.
You've been talking to him?
We got him out of Moscow about 3 hours ago. And debriefed him as quickly as possible.
We think they don't know he's gone. Even if they do know, it's no reason for them not to go ahead with their plan.
The telephone beside Rackham's seat beeped once. He picked it up, listened, pressed a button and handed it over to Petra.
All right, the rockets have launched.
I assume I need the country code?
No, put in the number as if you were still in Yerevan. As far as they'll know, you are. Tell them that you're conferring with Peter, and you'll rejoin them with the attack in progress.
Will we?
And then call your mother and tell her you're all right and not to talk about what happened.
Oh, that's about an hour too late.
My men told her that if she called anyone but you until she heard from you again, she'd be very sorry.
Thank you for terrifying her even more. Do you have any idea what this woman has been through in her life?
It always turns out all right, though. So she's better off than some.
Thanks for your cheery optimism. A few minutes later, the strike force was launched, and a warning was given to evacuate the airport, reroute all incoming flights, evacuate the parts of Yerevan nearest the airport, and alert the men at all possible military targets inside Armenia. As for Petra's mother, she was crying so hard, with relief, with anger at what had happened, that Petra could hardly make herself understood. But finally the conversation ended, and Petra was more pissed off than ever.
What gives you the right? Why do you think you...
War gives me the right, said Rackham. If I'd waited till you could come home and get your babies and then meet us at the airport, this plane would never have taken off. I have my men's lives to think of here, not just your mother's feelings.
Bean put a hand on Petra's knee. She accepted the need for calm and fell silent.
Mazer, said Bean, what's this about? You could have warned us with a phone call.
We have your other babies.
Petra was already emotional. She burst into tears. Quickly she controlled herself and hated the fact that she had acted so maternal.
All of them? At once?
We've been watching some of them for several weeks, said Rackham, waiting for an opportune moment.
Bean waited only a moment before saying,
waiting for Peter to tell you that it was all right, that you didn't need us anymore for his war.
He still needs you, said Rackham, as long as he can have you.
Why did you wait, Mazer?
How many? Said Petra. How many are there?
One more with Bean syndrome, said Rackham. Four more without it.
That's eight, said Bean.
Where's the ninth?
Rackham shook his head.
So you're still looking?
No, we're not, said Rackham.
So you have definite information that the ninth wasn't implanted?
Or it's dead?
No. We have definite information that whether it's alive or dead, we have no search criteria left. If the ninth baby was ever born, Valescu hid the birth and the mother too well. Or the mother is hiding herself. The software, the mind game, if you will, has been very effective. We wouldn't have found any of the normal children without its creative searches. But it also knows when it has nothing more to try. You have eight of the nine. Three of them have the syndrome, five are normal.
What about Valescu? Asked Petra.
Can we drug him?
Why not torture? Said Rackham.
No, Petra, we can't, because we need him.
For what? His virus?
We already have his virus, and it doesn't work. It's a bust. Failure. Dead end.
Valescu knew it, too. He just enjoyed tormenting us with the thought that he had endangered the entire world.
So what do you need him for? Demanded Petra.
We need him to work on the cure for Bean and the babies.
Oh, right, said Bean. You're going to turn him loose in a lab.
No, said Rackham. We're going to put him in space, on an asteroid-based research station, closely supervised. He's been tried and is under sentence of death for terrorism, kidnapping, and murder,
the murders of your brothers, Bean.
There's no death sentence, said Bean.
There is in military court in space, said Rackham. He knows he's alive as long as he's making progress on finding a legitimate cure for you and the babies. Eventually, our team of co-researchers will know everything he knows. When we don't need him anymore,
I don't want him killed, said Bean.
No, said Petra. I want him killed slowly.
He might be evil, said Bean. But I wouldn't exist if not for him.
There was a day, said Rackham, when that would be the biggest crime you charged him with.
I've had a good life, said Bean.
Strange and hard sometimes, but I've had a lot of happiness.
He squeezed Petra's knee.
I don't want you to kill him. You saved your own life from him, said Petra. You owe him nothing.
It doesn't matter, said Rackham. We have no intention of killing him. When he's no longer useful, he goes into a colony ship. He's not a violent man. He's very smart. He could be useful in understanding alien biota. It would be a waste of resource to kill him. And there's no colony that will have equipment he could adapt to create anything biologically destructive.
You've thought of everything, said Petra.
Again, said Bean, you could have told us this over the telephone. I didn't want to, said Rackham. The IF doesn't send a team like this, or a man like you, on an errand like this, just because you didn't want to use the phone.
We want to send you now, said Rackham.
In case you haven't been listening to yourself, said Petra, there's a war on.
Bean and Rackham ignored her.
They just looked at each other for a long time.
And then Petra saw that Bean's eyes were welling up with tears. That didn't happen very often.
What's happening, Bean?
Bean shook his head.
To Rackham, he said, Do you have them?
Rackham took an envelope out of his inside jacket pocket and handed it to Bean. He opened the envelope, removed a thin sheaf of papers, and handed them to Petra.
It's our divorce decree, said Bean.
Petra understood at once. He wasn't taking her with him. He was leaving her behind with the normal children. He was going to take the three children with the syndrome out into space with him. He wanted her to be free to remarry.
You are my husband, she said.
She tore the papers in half.
Those are copies, said Bean. The divorce has legal force whether you like it or not, whether you sign them or not. You're no longer a married woman.
Why? Because you think I'm going to remarry?
Bean ignored her.
But all the children have been certified as legitimately ours. They aren't bastards. They aren't orphans. They aren't adopted. They're the children of divorced parents. And you have custody of five of them, and I have custody of three. If the ninth one is ever found, then you'll have custody.
That ninth one is the only reason I'm listening to this, said Petra. Because if you stay, you'll die. And if we both go, then there might be a child who...
But she was too angry to finish. Because when Bean planned this, he couldn't have known there'd be one child missing. He'd already done this and kept it secret from her for...
How long have you been planning this? Asked Petra.
Tears were streaming down her face, but she kept her voice steady enough to speak.
Since we found Ramon and we knew there were normal children, said Bean.
It's more complicated than that, said Rackham.
Petra, I know how hard this is for you.
No, you don't.
Yes, I damn well do, said Rackham. I left a family behind when I went out into space on the same kind of relativistic turnaround voyage that Bean's embarking on. I divorced my wife before I went. I have her letters to me. All the anger and bitterness. And then, the reconciliation. And then, a long letter near the end of her life, telling me about how she and her second husband were happy. And the children turned out well. And she still loved me. I wanted to kill myself. But I did what I had to do. So don't tell me I don't know how hard this is.
You had no choice, said Petra. But I could go with him. We could take all the children and...
Petra, said Bean.
If we had conjoined twins, we'd separate them. Even if one of them was sure to die, we'd separate them, so that at least one of them could lead a normal life.
Petra's tears were out of control now.
Yes, she understood his reasoning. The children without the syndrome could have a normal life on Earth. Why should they spend their childhood confined to a starship when they could have the normal chance of happiness?
Why couldn't you at least let me be part of the decision? Said Petra, when she finally got control of her voice.
Why did you cut me out? Did you think I wouldn't understand?
I was selfish, said Bean. I didn't want to spend our last months together arguing about it. I didn't want you to be grieving for me and Ender and Bella the whole time you were with us. I wanted to take these past few months with me when I go. It was my last wish, and I knew you'd grant it to me, but the only way I could have that wish is if you didn't know.
So now, Petra, I ask you, let me have these months without you knowing what was going to happen.
You already have them. You stole them.
Yes, so now I ask you, please, let me have them. Let me know you forgive me for it, that you give them to me freely, now, after the fact.
Petra couldn't forgive him. Not now. Not yet.
But there was no later. She buried her face in his chest and held him and wept. While she cried, Rackham spoke on calmly.
Only a handful of us know what's really happening. And on Earth, outside of the IF, only Peter will know. Is that clear? So this divorce document is absolutely secret. As far as anyone else will know, Bean is not in space. He died in the raid on Tehran. And he took no babies with him. There were never more than five. And two of the normal babies that we've recovered are also named Andrew and Bella. As far as anyone knows, you will still have all the children you ever did.
Petra pulled back from her embrace of Bean and glared savagely at Rackham.
You mean you're not even going to let me grieve for my babies? No one will know what I've lost except you and Peter Wiggin.
Your parents, said Rackham, have seen Ender and Bella. It's your choice whether to tell them the truth or to stay away from them until enough time has passed that they can't tell that there's been a change.
Then I'll tell them.
Think about it first, said Rackham. It's a heavy burden.
Don't presume to teach me how to love my parents, said Petra. You know and I know that at every point in this, you've decided solely on the basis of what's good for the Ministry of Colonization and the International Fleet.
We'd like to think we found the solution that's best for everyone.
I'm supposed to have a funeral for my husband when I know he's not dead, and that's what's best for me?
I will be dead, said Bean, for all intents and purposes. Gone and never coming back. And you'll have children to raise.
And yes, Petra, said Rackham, there is a wider consideration. Your husband is already a legendary figure.
If it's known that he's still alive, then everything Peter does will be ascribed to him. There'll be legends about how he's going to return, about how the most brilliant graduate of battle school really planned out everything Peter did.